Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up on the south side of Chicago and worked as a bagger for Jewel Food Stores. He graduated from Western Michigan University and began working for the Chicago White Sox in 1978 for $8,000 a year. In 1991, as general manager, he formed the Florida Marlins and led them to a World Series championship in 1997. Today, he's the president and general manager of the Detroit Tigers. His name, Dave Dombrowski. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, the CEO, president, and general manager of the Detroit Tigers. Dave, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Well, thank you, Jack. Thanks for having me here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure, I'd love to. It's a great memories for me. I grew up in the south side of Chicago, suburbs we moved to at a young age. My parents were working parents, very young parents, parents that basically was a honeymoon child, and married in their early 20s. My dad worked at a Chevrolet dealership and was a parts department manager for the same Chevy dealership for 45 years. And my mom worked all the time when I was a youngster. She worked different jobs. A lot of times she would work at night because we couldn't basically afford a babysitter at that time all the time. So grew up in a very small home, very humble type of situation. Two younger sisters, one 3 years younger than me by the name of Donna, and another one much younger by the name of Kelly, that's 11 years younger, who still all live in the south suburbs near my parents' house.
What did you learn from mom and dad?
A lot of things. And I think at the time, of course, you realize you're not learning anything at that time. You think that, but you learn so much. I think my parents were a lot of work ethic, discipline, being in a position, honesty. They always had preached basically drive and success, work hard for everything that you do. My dad, I don't remember a time in which he ever missed a day of work. I think my whole life, I don't think he ever was sick when I was a youngster. He'd leave the house at 6 o'clock in the morning. He'd come in at 6:30 at night, 5 days a week. It was like clockwork. He'd come in because I remember at that time Dick Van Dyke would start right at 6:30, and my dad would be walking in the house at that same time every time. But it was a family orientation. And so they basically were blue-collar workers that taught you all the work ethic that you needed to do, to have, to be successful, to have that drive, and to make sure that you could always hold your head up high. Because what you did, you could be proud of what you did.
What were your first jobs?
Well, my first jobs, they weren't pretty. It was one of those where you did what my parents had believed when I was a youngster. And it's interesting because they did always work. But they always had said when I was real young, you'll have plenty of time to work when you get older. So there were no paper routes like a lot of people have when they are starting off. My first job was really at a food chain store there in the Chicagoland area, a place called Jewel, which was big at that point and still is in the Chicagoland area. It's not here in the Michigan area, but it's in the Chicagoland area, the largest food store. And I was a bagger at that time, so I'd bag groceries when I was in high school, pick up the carts when they were in the parking lot and bring them in and make sure they were put in the proper places. And it was a part-time job in the school season. I'd work 4 or 5 hours a night. A lot of times, remember the next morning being very tired when it came time to go to school, and worked more full-time in the summertime. But that was my first job. It was a bagger at Jewel.
As you know, I'm from the south side of Chicago,
yes.
Too. And you're the first person from south side that I've known that went to Cornell. How did you ever go to Cornell?
Yeah, there weren't many people that would go to Cornell, and I remember them telling me that at the time. It was interesting because I went to a place called Richards High School. It's in Oak Lawn, Illinois, which is south suburbs, and very good athletic conference at that time. It was called the South Suburban Conference, and it's sort of changed with some different schools that come in and out. Probably the most famous alum at this point athletically coming out of Dwayne Wade, who plays with the Miami Heat guard that's pretty good, that's was a basketball player at Richards High School. And I played sports there, my best sport at that time. Even though my favorite sport was baseball, my best sport in high school was football. And I was blessed to be doing well academically in school. And so I was an all-conference, all-area-type football player and baseball player. But for football, I was recruited to go to the Ivy League schools. I visited quite a few of them. I had the chance to go from an academic perspective and athletic perspective. I was not a star-type, Big Ten-type player that was going to go on and be a professional athlete, but I was a solid enough player to be recruited. So actually, Cornell University ended up recruiting me, and I ended up choosing to go there over the Ivy League, other Ivy League schools for I'm not really sure why at that point, other than it was just an appealing campus that just offered a good opportunity for me.
You then went to Western Michigan, and while you're still in school, you saved all your money to go to the baseball winter meetings in 1978. How much was that, and why did you do that?
Well, when I went to I transferred after my freshman year at Cornell University, and it was really a variety of reasons, but football coach that recruited me got let go. And actually, the new football coach coming in, which is an interesting story, was a guy by the name of George Seifert, who later coached the San Francisco 49ers to a Super Bowl championship. But with the change, a lot of times you don't have the same relationship with the new coach coming in. And from an athletic perspective, I was not going to be a pro athlete. So I ended up transferring and chose Western Michigan University at that point. And at that time, it really became more of a focus of mine on what I was going to do as far as growing up was concerned. What did I want to do? And I always loved baseball first and foremost. So I tried to get my foot in the front door, thought about trying to get in professional baseball, and it was recommended to me to go to the winter meetings would be the best place to try to get my foot in the door. And throughout my life, through my grandparents and my parents, various times in which they had given me money for my birthdays and for Christmas, that money had been saved up, and it was basically in a situation where I was going to spend it for my future. And I convinced my parents that my future was to go to the winter meetings in Honolulu, Hawaii, my senior year in college, and that's how I ended up going to the winter meetings.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, and when we come back, we'll ask him how he got his first job in baseball. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, who became the president of the Tigers in 2002. Dave, how'd you get your first job in baseball?
Well, I actually did fly to the winter meetings there, as we were talking about, in Honolulu my senior year. I was one semester short of graduation with the idea of trying to get a job after I graduated. I was fortunate enough at that time, I met a gentleman with the Chicago White Sox by the name of Roland Heeman, who was their general manager, and actually had met Roland the summer before when I was writing a paper called The General Manager, The Man in the Middle, which was a paper that was needed to graduate from the Honors College at Western Michigan. And so since Roland had recommended me to go to the winter meetings, that's why I ended up going. So at that point, I met Roland, and he had told me, he said, hold on here. He said, I remember meeting you. I might have something for you. He said, meet me back here the next morning, which I did. I ended up meeting him. He introduced me to a gentleman by the name of Paul Richards, who was a famous manager in professional baseball, catcher, and actually caught for the Tigers on the World Championship Club in 1945, and then flew back to Chicago, finished my last week of school, and I ended up interviewing with a couple people with the Chicago White Sox organization who were by the name of Bill Veeck, Rudy Schaefer, and then eventually Mike Veeck, who hired me for the job. And that's how I ended up getting my foot in the door. And the only thing that happened was is I had to start right then, one semester short of graduation, or else I couldn't get the job. And at that point, I decided that was the thing to do.
What was your initial pay? And did you use an agent?
Well, I wish I would have been able to afford an agent. But at that point, I remember it was a funny story because Mike Vec is still a good friend of mine to this day. And he offered me the job, and the original pay was actually $7,000 that he ended up offering me for the job. And I remember I came home, and my mother was in complete shock that I would consider taking a job a semester short of graduation in professional baseball, which, of course, wasn't high on her list compared to my dad's. So my dad said, well, let's sit down, let's talk about this. And he said, let's figure out all your expenses. And I wrote down all my expenses on a sheet of paper, a big yellow pad there, and I came up with $8,000 a year. And he said, if you can get $8,000 a year and at least break even, I can't let you start a job after getting a college education and lose money. You go ahead and take the job. So I went in to see Mike Vec the next day, and I sat down with Mike, and I go, Mr. Vec, I would really love the job, but I need to get a little bit more money. I'm just in a spot where I need to cover my expenses. And he says, well, what type of money are you talking about? And I said, well, I have them all written here, down here on my piece of paper. And he said, well, I don't need to see that. What are you talking about? I said, well, $8,000. And Mike Vec, to this day, we laugh because he says, well, normally we don't start people at that high of a salary around here. But because you're the type of person we want to get in the organization, we'll go ahead and we'll give you the $8,000 a year. So I represented myself through the consultation of my father, and I got that whole $8,000.
Years later, as you deal with all these agents, what's the most any agents ever asked for?
Oh, that's scary. Well, it's probably at that, I remember the Tejada negotiations. They hit us with some pretty high numbers for that time period. I think they hit us for about $120 million at that point. But about that $15 million per year for numerous years, which were about 8 years at that time.
What is it about baseball that's captivated the hearts of America for over 100 years?
It's a great question. And I think part of it is just the love of the game itself. People love to watch the game of the baseball. A lot of youngsters have played it. People have seen it for many years. But it also represents the rituals of spring and summer, the start of the change of the season from winter when you have springtime and in the summertime. And it's a game that people just love to watch and be able to converse at a casual basis. Yet for the most interested, serious fan, they can study every step of the game. So it appeals to a wide variety of individuals that can enjoy the game under different type of atmospheres.
What is it about baseball that the Cubs haven't won a World Series in 100 years?
You poor Cub fans, Jack. People from Chicago realize how many years it was until the World Championship, until last year, was won there. But those Cubs have had a tough time. You know what the story is there. It's basically called the Billy Goat.
And Steve Martin and everybody else. Baseball's a United Nations. It accepts any and all races, creeds, religions. And it's done a very good job of melting those together. Much better than baseball or communities. How has it done this and why?
Well, I think it's a game that appeals to so many different countries and people within those countries. People have seen it as an opportunity to be good, advance, progress, make a good living. And so these people can excel in playing baseball no matter what size they are. There are people that can be very small, they can be very big. And I think that international appeal of the game is there because people see it as a sport that they love that creates opportunity. And all of us that are interested and involved in the game, we're interested in one thing, and that's winning. And you put the best players, no matter what type of background that they have, you just want to make sure you put a winning club together.
Who's the best ball player you've ever watched?
That's another great question. And I would say I have to break it down two ways. As a youngster, where I recollect watching baseball, but not watching day in and day out at that point, I remember Roberto Clemente. He came into Wrigley Field, and I would watch the Pirates play, and he just caught my eye. The way he could not only hit, run, but take that ball off the right field wall and fire it to third base on a fly, right on the button, time after time. He caught my eye as a youngster, but as I've been in the game, the name that clearly stands out for me is Barry Bonds, what he can do on the ball field, and it's just phenomenal. Now we all remember him from the offensive perspective, but he could play defense. He was a Gold Glove winner. He could throw. He could run. He could do it all, and to me, he's the most feared hitter in my time. So to me, Barry Bonds would win that hands down at this time.
You've seen many extremely talented ballplayers. You've drafted and signed many extremely talented ballplayers that didn't become great major leaguers. And then you've seen some with much less talent that have become great. What's the difference?
It can be summarized pretty easily in one way, yet very difficultly in another. And I think that it's called work ethic. Because if you look at some players, now they have to have the talent to some extent, because you can have a bunch of people that work hard and they just don't have enough ability. But the ability to continue to work hard, to drive, to try to be successful and do everything they can, and in turn still have some ability, is what can make the difference from those players being successful.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, and in the words of Jim McKay, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. He's lived through both. When we'll come back, we'll talk about it. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Dave Dombrowski. Dave? 1997, the fifth year of existence with the Marlins. You started the thing. You win the World Series. You're the champs. That's the thrill of victory. 2003, the Tigers come within one loss of having the worst record in the history of baseball. How have you lived through both of those?
I like 97 a lot better, I will say that. But I think that there are a few key factors there, and I think that first of all, you build throughout your career. Well, you establish some self-confidence in your ability and the people around you. And the experience we had in 1997 and building the Florida Marlins organization, you almost can't put into words that feeling of achieving the ultimate goal that you have professionally. Is just, it runs through every part of your body, every piece of every vein that you have. It gives you the ultimate thrill. And I remember that game 7. And if somebody would have told me that game lasted 4 minutes or over 4 hours, which it did, it wouldn't have surprised me either way. That's how exciting that game was for me, and how just every breath you took was just totally grasped you during that time period. Then you go to the other extreme and the loss perspective. And I think during that, you have to have a lot of confidence in your abilities, because you know you're going to be criticized. You know in your heart you're doing the right thing for the franchise, although nobody anticipates losing 119 games. I'd always gone with the credo that Tommy Lasorda talked about, that you win one-third, you lose one-third, and it's those middle 54 that make a difference. But in that situation, we lost more than that. But it was necessary. We knew we needed to do that in order to take the next step, which is the ultimate goal, and that's where I think you can't get lost. The ultimate goal is winning the world championship. It's not getting above 500. It's not winning the division, which, of course, you'd love to do, but you'd like to be in a spot to win the world championship, and those are the steps we needed to take.
What was it like going to the White House with the Marlins?
A great experience. And unfortunately, we lost some of the feel of the team being together, because we already had to break the team up at that point, because the ownership had given us that credo that we had to break the team up. So a lot of players didn't take the trip that they normally would have. But still, the experience of going to the White House, having that chance to go there as a world champion, meeting the president, who was President Clinton at that time, and having that experience is just one in which you can barely describe, because it was such an emotional, fun-filled, and exhilarating day.
You work your whole life, you know, to become the best, and you get there, And then ownership says, Dave, we don't have the money. We have to break this up. How did you accept that?
Well, I think at that point, I remember that time because it really caught me. I was hopeful that it would not happen, but it did end up happening. And it was a Thursday afternoon after we won the championship after midnight on Monday, and we had the celebration the next day, the parades. And I remember at that point being in a spot where after you got over feeling sorry for yourself, the self-pity, the anger of having that happen to you, the realization that this is what's going to take place, you had to make a decision. And the decision to me was clear. You either tackle it with the best of your ability and do the best job you possibly can as an employee for your organization and lead with your head held high, knowing that that's what is necessary, or you quit at that point. Because if you're not going to tackle that situation with the right enthusiasm that you need to have as an organizational leader, you needed to step back. And for me, quitting wasn't an option at that point, and we just decided to tackle it the best way we possibly could.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, and when we come back, we'll ask him what it's like being in the public eye every day. And I'm Jack Prasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Dave Dombrowski, the third longest tenured general manager in baseball today. You're going to become the Casey Stengel of general manager pretty soon. Connie Mack, the new Connie Mack. When you're in the public eye and every Monday morning quarterback analyzes your every decision, some of them they keep analyzing for years. How do you handle this?
I think, first of all, you need to realize that that's part of the fun for people of the game of baseball. Everybody, or most people, consider themselves an expert and that they can do your job better than you can. So that's part of the charm of the game itself, just as the charm is for a fan to come to the ballpark and second-guess the manager. If the manager bunts, you can also hit and run, you can steal, you can just swing away. So you always have options. And people, because they've played our game, and have seen the game for a long time, think that they know more than you do. In addition to that, from my own perspective, taking pride in the work that you do, you realize that any decision you've made, people can second guess it. At times you'll make wrong decisions, but nobody will put more thought into the decision than I have and the people that are in the organization than we have. We spend so much time preparing and getting all the information we possibly can in order to make a decision. You realize that. And I think in addition to that, then you have to have thick skin. You just have to realize that it's going to happen. People are going to say things at times that aren't going to be very nice. And you just have to be in a position to realize that it comes with the territory. And if you don't have thick skin, you're probably in the wrong business.
You need a lot of self-confidence. For our young listeners, they know they need self-confidence, but if they don't have it, how do they get it?
Well, I guess if we knew that one exactly, you'd be able to bottle it up. But I do think that there are some factors there. One is you need to do and accomplish as much preparation as you possibly can. You need to put yourself in a position where you can be successful and afterwards not look at the decision that you've made and say, what if I would have done this, or what if I would have done that, or if I would have worked harder, or I would have looked at this choice. You have to make sure that you do all of those things beforehand and then be willing to take the consequences that are afterwards. And just realize that, I think when you talk about self-confidence, you realize that you're doing a solid job, you're doing a good job, you've got good people around you, you're going to make as a wise decision as you possibly can, and that you realize also you're not always going to be right. And I think, again, part of that will be you have to realize that you as a person are more than just the right or wrong decision you make, that you've got a strong family, you've got love in your family, you've got love in your life, and there are other things that take place other than just that particular decision. So there's a lot that's involved in that, but I think ultimately it comes down to that deep in your heart and deep in your soul, you know that you've made a wise decision.
When you're leading a team, any business, organization, university, You need patience and you need persistence. Can you talk about these two?
Patience and persistence. I think that sometimes people don't realize they can go hand in hand. You can be persistent and you need to constantly work to achieve what you possibly can, and that comes through hard work. And there's no easy way through it a lot of times. People will look for easy ways. It's just being persistent. Keep trying, effort. And people need that type of work ethic philosophy to be successful. But also, you have to be in a spot to realize that rewards don't always come immediately. So sometimes you have to be patient with the decisions that you make. And you have to realize when those decisions are being made that look towards the future at times. Be willing to take some criticism for the long-term success and realize that that's, again, part of the territory of your leader. Being patient is a very, very important quality to have.
Every team needs a leader in the clubhouse. Can you talk about leadership?
Leadership is something that's important in every walk of life for every type of business, and I can only relate to professional baseball because I've only been in baseball my working career. But I think that leaders, when they walk into the room, you're in a position, you realize that that person's willing to take on leadership. Well, what's leadership? They're willing to stand in front of the group. They're willing to put their neck on the line. They're willing to give people their vision, take charge, be prepared, put people in a position around them that make them better as individuals and make your organization better. So you're in a spot where you put good people around you and provide the leadership for them. I think also, too, leaders for me, especially in our industry, they're in a position where they're willing to take the blame and pass on the credit. So they let other people get the plaudits that are associated with the positive aspects, and you publicly are in a spot that you are taking the brunt of the criticism if need be. And I think also, as a leader, you have to realize that sometimes as a leader, you can't always be people's friends. Sometimes you have to make tough decisions. And even though you care about somebody, even though you're in a position where you have certain feelings, you're making a decision from a leadership perspective of a company that are in a spot where you sometimes have to make tough decisions that will make you unpopular.
Speaking of which, Ellen Trammell, loved by everybody, as loyal as the day is long to the Tigers, worked very hard. How did you tell him?
It's a tough one. Ellen Trammell is a superb person. What he's done for Detroit baseball speaks for itself. But it was one of those where it was not easy to have that, to just sit down face to face and come into my office. He came into my office on the Monday morning and talk to him about what the alternatives were and the decision that eventually was made and my reasonings behind it. And just basically told him face to face at that particular time what my heart told me. It was not easy, and I can understand that people love him. If you don't love Ellen Trammell, there's something that's probably you're missing something, because they don't make people much nicer than him.
We've been talking about courage. For our young listeners, if they don't have courage, how do they get courage?
That's a question that probably everybody would have to dig down themselves, but I think that they need to get the self-confidence. They need to be able to dig in what where they can eventually take that on their shoulders. And to gain that type of courage would be something I think would be an individual would have to look at themselves and how they would gain that. But I think it's putting your neck on the line, being willing to take what comes with the territory, and realize that your life is not going to be decided just upon each and every decision that you make, but willing to take the consequences of that decision.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, and when we come back, we'll ask him about the 2006 Tiger season, which opens tomorrow against Kansas City. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Dave Dombrowski, who was profiled on billboards throughout Michigan in 2005 by Western Michigan University. What was that like the first time you saw a picture of yourself and the kids saw a picture of yourself?
Humbling, embarrassing a little bit. I remember when the phone call was originally made, my secretary took the call. Her name's Patricia. And she's known the people from Western Michigan for quite a while. And I was very busy. And she said, Jamie Jeremy from Western has called and wants to know if it'd be all right if they use a picture of you on a billboard. And I said, well, yeah, that sounds fine. It sounds okay. So, well, I'll have them send a copy. And they sent one. But I thought it was going to be like this little small billboard in Kalamazoo. And it ends up being all over the place throughout the state of Michigan. But it was humbling, but it was also one where I'm glad that it helped the university. The university's done a lot for me.
The 2006 season starts tomorrow. What's your prediction?
I've never been very good on big on predicting the wins and losses, but I do think we're in a spot where we're going to be markedly improved. I like our ball club. I think it has a combination of some factors that are extremely important. We have some veteran players on our ball club that have had good years in recent years, so they're not over the hill. We're in a spot where we have some young veterans that are improved, and you can see they're at the point where they should start to excel. And we also have some good young talent on our club and in the organization for the first time in years. So you put all those groups together and those players together under the guidance of Jim Leland and his staff, and I think that we're in a position where our goal is to be playing meaningful games in September for us, and that would be a tremendous stride, and we'll see where that takes us.
Speaking of Jim Leland, 60 years old, he was the manager of the Marlins when they won. He was National League Manager of the Year twice, won 3 division championships, but he hasn't managed in 6 years. Why did you name him the manager?
I think Jim Leland is one of the best managers in professional baseball and has been that way over the last 20 years. He has not managed in the 6 years, but I think Jim Leland managing a baseball game is like when you haven't ridden a bike in a few years. You just can do that. He's been around the game. He's been a scout with the Cardinals organization. He worked with them in spring training. He managed some games in spring training for Tony La Russa when they would have a split squad. And I think the key for Jim Leland is one big difference at this point. He had to show me that he had the passion back to manage. If he had the passion back, he's a difference maker. And they're hard to find. He not only can manage a game, he's a leader. He provides what a club needs in the situation we are, where we're talented with some young players and we're at the spot where we can compete. You need to have a certain type of leader for that, and Jim can do that. And so I think for me, it was just a matter, you could see that burning passion and desire back in his eyes. And we've known each other a long time. We've known each other over 20 years. We met back in the Chicago White Sox organization back in the early 80s. He coached third base when I was in the front office. We remained friends throughout that time period. And so for me, it was easy to see when he had that passion back.
Speaking of legendary, you worked early in your career for Bill Veeck, legendary. The owner, legendary owner of the St. Louis Browns, the White Sox. He was the man who put the midget Eddie Goodell in, put the only one-armed guy, Pete Gray, in the major leagues. Can you talk about Bill Veeck?
Fascinating. One of the most fascinating people I've ever met in my life. Maybe is the most fascinating. And it was always an adventure every single day that you went to the ballpark. Now, when I was at that stage of my career, not always day-to-day did I rub elbows with Bill, but you had such a small organization back then in 1978 with the White Sox compared to where we are now. We have as many interns now as we did full-time employees in the White Sox organization back in 1978. But I always tell people that it was like going to get my doctorate degree working for Bill Veeck. He challenged you every day. He knew about so many different aspects of life in general. He created a family-type atmosphere, didn't have a lot of money at that time in comparison to other owners, but he created an atmosphere in which you were always challenged to do things, gave young people an opportunity, and he surrounded himself with such good people. And if you were at the ballpark at Comiskey Park at that time, you saw a walk of famous people constantly come through to visit Bill, and you had a chance to listen to them talk about baseball. And that they used to talk baseball all hours of the night. There were many nights that I would get home at 4 o'clock in the morning after driving Bill Veeck and Roland Heeman home and be back at the ballpark by 8 o'clock in the morning. I never thought two thoughts about it. I loved what I was doing, and I was very, very fortunate to be able to have the opportunity to work for somebody like Bill.
We have a legendary man here, Mr. Illich. Can you talk about him?
Well, of course, what he's accomplished here in the city of Detroit and with the Red Wings organization and his passion and love for sports and the Tigers. I find him a fascinating individual also. Very, very smart, a great businessman. He's a person that challenges you also. And you want to be successful for somebody like Mr. I and bring him the success with the Tigers that he's enjoyed with some of the other business opportunities that he's had, because it's a passion. People don't realize how much he loves the Tigers and what he'll do to make you successful. So for me, he's been very supportive. He works hand in hand with us. He's given us the opportunity to be successful in the organization, and I sure do want to see it happen for him.
Sports administration as a career. A lot of young people would love to get into it. Is it still a viable option? And if so, how do I get started?
It's a viable option, but it's also a competitive option at this point. There are a lot of people. It's a law of supply and demand, so you have to realize you're competing against a lot of people to get into professional sports nowadays. And there are sports administration programs offered in many different colleges around the country. So you have to be, as I tell people, you have to be persistent, but yet not a pain. You have to be willing to take the setback of receiving a rejection letter that tells you there are no job opportunities available, and yet keep plugging ahead. And I tell people it's important to be able to offer something to an organization, give you an edge over somebody else, something that gives you an advantage. So when you get that resume and you have a chance to meet somebody, they can offer your organization something that other people can't. And that can vary from individual to individual. So I think that those are all important areas for somebody in sports administration to get started.
Who's the best young ball player out there today?
Well, if I was going to choose a player to start a franchise, and it would normally go against my thinking of starting with a corner player, but it would be Albert Pujols. And he's only 25 years of age. He's one of the best offensive players in the game at this point and in the history of the game as a youngster. And he also provides leadership. He's a tremendous individual with a great work ethic. So if you're going to put him in the middle of your lineup, you've got somebody for 10 to 15 years that can be in the middle of your lineup at that point. Take the pressure off your young player. Show him how to win. The other person that you'd give a lot of consideration is Alex Rodriguez, because not only is he so talented, he could play shortstop if he had to. If he was with another club, he'd be playing short other than with the Yankees with Derek Jeter there. But I think I'd give the slight edge to Pujols.
What advice would you give to any young person today?
I would advise them to try to do what they can to be successful, to work hard. But I think a lot of people today that come in, that they are so worried about the future and where they're going, they should be more worried about the present. Worry about the task at hand. Worry about what you can control, which is what you're trying to do yourself. And don't worry about all the things that you can't control that other people are going to decide. If you take care of your own business, you'll usually be in a position where you'll be successful.
2 months ago, Southeast Michigan had one of the greatest weeks in the last 40, 50 years, that Super Bowl week. We amazed ourselves at what we accomplished. Everybody's been talking about we got to keep that. What's the key to keeping that, Dave?
Unity and togetherness. I think that people, if they can keep together and work together like they did for that time during the Super Bowl, you saw everybody working for a common goal to make our area be in a position where they thrived, they looked like we were a community that could accept anything. And to me, working together as a community is the real key.
What are you proudest of?
I'm proudest of being a good father, being a person, a good family man, and being in a position where I'd be able to day in and day out hold my head high with what I'm able to accomplish. But I love being a father with my two children and a good husband, and I think to me that being a family man is something I'm extremely proud.
Thanks for coming on, Dave Dombrowski. Thanks for what you do, and most importantly, the style and the manner, the class with which you do it. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 Sports.